Hey, everybody. How you doing? In a moment, coming up is Dr. Nick Begich, and what a program this is going to be. Ken Kaiser from Galien, Ohio, said, hey, Art, how is smoking accepted where you're at? Well, meaning here in the Philippines. A lot of Filipinos smoke, no question about that. They shouldn't, but they do. Accepted? Not at all. It's not allowed in any public building. Can you believe that? I thought, boy, when you get to the Philippines, it's going to be wide open. And they don't allow it anywhere. Not in restaurants, not in stores of any kind. They just don't, they plain don't allow it. That's all there is to it. That's item A. Item B, I was distressed to find. For example, I have a pack of Marlboros here in my hand right now. 20 Class A cigarettes, it says. On the side, it says, government warning, cigarette smoking is dangerous to your health. Not for sale to minors, it says. And otherwise, you would not know it from any other. Well, it does say manufactured in Batangas, Philippines. Other than that, there's no difference, except that the pack of cigarettes here cost 37 pesos. 37 pesos. Now, again, at 50 pesos to the dollar, there went one reason to stop, you know, money. It's expensive. It's cheap here. 37 pesos for a pack of cigarettes. That tells you how much tax really is applied to a pack of cigarettes. It does indeed. All right. Coming up in a moment, Dr. Nick Begich is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. Begich received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in 1994. Dr. Begich serves as executive director of the Lay Institute on Technology and is also the publisher and co-owner of Earth Pulse Press Incorporated, an Alaska-based organization. Nick is currently lecturing on new invasive technologies as well as new breakthroughs in healing sciences that are emerging. He also has been lecturing on the impact of our technologies on humankind and the planet in the 21st century. And, of course, he's the author of that book, Angels Don't Play That Harp, as well as many others. And we are going to ask him for the very latest on harp in just a moment. We have done many programs with Dr. Nick Begich on this intriguing technology called HARP, which is an ionospheric heater, this incredible thing up in Alaska that points at the ionosphere and is capable of burning a hole right through it with intensely focused RF energy or many, many other things, bouncing it off the ionosphere, perhaps confusing troops on the ground, all kinds of things. We've done that show over the years. We will touch on many other things tonight than that. However, welcome to the program, Dr. Begich.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you again. It's been a while, and we're just glad to be on the air again and talking about these very important topics.
They are important topics. And before we move on to, we've got a lot more to do tonight. I see that you've really broadened out what you're able to talk about and what you're investigating. But I would like to get the latest on HARP. Since we last spoke, Doctor, what has been going on with HARP?
Well, you know, HARP has changed hands a little bit. I think the last time we were on, it was still being run by the Air Force and Navy. DARPA now has control of the project. Drops it down a little bit in terms of how they classify material. DARPA is a defense research agency, and they basically look at the implications of technologies that maybe have things that are considered black or those things that are hidden from public view. You know, HARP also has changed hands, you know, in terms of the patent record over the years. I have stayed in contact with the inventor, Dr. Bernard Eastland, and he has continued to do work in one particular area associated with HARP, and that's weather modification. And he did a follow-on report for the European Space Agency to use HARP-type arrays, these field of antennas, for weather modification. He then went on to do another study for, interestingly enough, a joint study for NASA and FEMA, utilizing the same ideas but a space-based technology using high-powered lasers for weather modification. And then in 2005, he delivered a paper at the University of Pennsylvania where he had actually started to look at the use of something much different, using gravitational and acoustic waves for weather modification. And what he found is that he could do this with 1,600 times less energy than what he originally thought was necessary when HARP was first conceived. So, you know, in that particular vein, I know Dr. Eastland has continued to move in that direction. The one change is he is not delivering that technology to the government. He feels like weather modification is such a controversial issue that it really belongs in the public. It's something that shouldn't be hidden. Basically, if we're going to do it, we need to do it much differently than we have in the past. And I think HARP, as a system, what we see is a lot more integration and cooperation between countries. As you know, we opposed it in the European Parliament years ago and actually had a resolution passed in the European Parliament where HARP was, in fact, looked at as a technology that ought to be significantly restricted because of its environmental potential and consequences.
Okay. Let's back up a little bit. And we'll certainly get to the weather modification, Dr. Eastland, but you said the patent has changed and that DARPA is now running HARP. Now, that has some pretty ominous implications in my mind. What? Obviously, it's gone dark. It's gone black. So we probably don't know, but Doctor, if you were to guess what DARPA's intent now for HARP is, what would you guess?
Well, I would go back to their own literature, and I would say that they intend to fully implement the absolute capabilities, which deal a lot more with interference and with communications, with ground-penetrating tomography, or this idea in the vernacular or by analogy would be like X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth. In fact, that showed up in on November 27th in an MSNBC report right after the 9/11 incident, where they were going to use HARP technology to go over and locate all the underground facilities. We never heard what became of that, but as you start to look into HARP and you realize that beyond all of the straight-up military applications that are in the open record, there are these other areas, geophysical manipulation, the idea of changing components of the environment for weapons applications. In other words, to be able to think about weather warfare or the generation of earthquakes or volcanic eruptions using electromagnetic waves, something that most people think is strictly impossible. Actually, you can go back to the language of the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, and he was commenting on various weapons and their capabilities, and he talked about these very same technologies. And what he said in a DOD press briefing, and I quote, others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climates, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. This is the stuff that HARP could indeed do. When we looked at later reports, there was an Army report where they were really looking at this technology primarily to control a battle environment or to even wage war without anybody knowing it. I mean, now we have preemptive warfare. We also have the capability of waging it in a way where the environment becomes the weapon.
Do you believe that we have actually reached that point with that DARPA has now reached that point with that capability?
Absolutely. I firmly believe it. I think the evidence expresses it. You know, from the time Gene Manning and I wrote the book Angels Don't Play This HARP, we produced, I produced a follow-on series with my co-author Jim Roderick, Earth Rising the Revolution, Earth Rising 2, both of which we continue to follow technology trends, not just HARP, but the diversity of trends. And, You know, one of the things that I think is the most revealing is sort of the convergence of technologies. As we see these technologies advance, they're no longer advancing sort of in isolation. Because of the distribution of information and the data flow, we're seeing convergences of technology where even more powerful systems, for instance, with HARP, when you connect HARP with the capability of supercomputers, when you combine HARP with the latest information on biophysics, the effect of electromagnetic energy on living systems, then you start to get into some areas that become very alarming. In fact, the latest book that we've just released in August was Controlling the Human Mind, Technologies of Political Control. And HARP does play a part in that, in the sense that it has the ability to modulate the electromagnetic field lines of the planet in such a way as to deliver on what Dr. Persinger at Laurentian University proposed in one of his papers, which was if we could figure out how to modulate the magnetic fields of the Earth, we could manipulate behavior over huge geographic areas.
This All right, well, you and I both know, Doctor, that they're not going to get to a specific battlefield application, for example, until they've damn well tested this. Now, what I'm about to say is a reach out into the fringe, but that's what I do on this program, is reach to the fringe. There have been, I have noted, I said it the other day, it's almost as though some evil has begun propagating, much the way radio waves, I said, and television waves have propagated. Now, HARP indeed propagates in exactly that way. Now, is there any possibility that they've been testing HARP and affecting human beings, not just in North America, but perhaps even around the world? We know that there's a history of our government willing to test on its own people or others.
That's right.
Could this have been going on, Doctor?
Absolutely. In fact, it was Secretary of Energy O'Leary that admitted under the Clinton administration that 500,000 Americans had been victims of human experimentation without their consent.
Exactly.
You know, when you think about these systems, yes, absolutely, I believe they would be applied. When you go back even as far as 1969, the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, a geophysicist and advisor to President Lyndon Johnson, suggested that these technologies would evolve. And, you know, it was Lyndon Johnson that was getting biweekly reports on, for instance, wiretapping and monitoring of all the congressional offices during the Vietnam War. You know, the idea of surveillance technologies and using technologies to gain political advantage has been the subject of many writers, including Zbigniew Brzezinski while he was at Columbia University. In the book Between Two Ages, he actually suggests that we would one day develop systems that would be able to manipulate behavior over huge geographic areas by being able to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way to return a signal to the Earth. And what that book also said is that all these technologies, as they evolved, would be used, no matter who was in power, liberal or conservative, to further their political ends, on the idea that they were doing good. I mean, in their minds, they're doing good. In everyone else's minds, manipulating other people's behavior, I think most of us would find highly objectionable.
I should say. So, you know, we read these horrible headlines every day of people committing crimes that seem to have no motive whatsoever except to propagate as much death as an individual can propagate before either taking their own life or having the police take their life. And you just shake your head at them. There just can't be a reason for this other than just sort of evil propagating. And so I know it's a long reach to say, could HARP be doing this? But could HARP be doing this? And I guess the answer is yeah.
Yeah, it could be. You know, and it's not such a long reach. And I'll tell you what we found in our work. Well, we were looking at all of the different ways in which human behavior can be altered and mitigated. I found over 300 source documents that we actually used. And these are primarily academic studies, government reports, U.S. patents, military documents that are non-classified. And as we compiled the material and took a look at it, you know, in terms of that specific instance where you get this sort of lone person that just acts out in a totally bizarre way,
yes.
We were asked over the years about those instances, and until I really got into this research the last couple of years, we pin down a whole history that traces it through a very interesting character by the name of George Estabrooks. George Estabrooks worked initially in the Harvard labs back in the 20s studying hypnosis, and that's where he kind of started, and he believed that you could actually create what he said was the super spy by taking a person into a very deep state of hypnosis and deliberately fracturing the personality, where one side of his personality would know everything about the other, and the other would be basically dumb. It would just know what it was programmed, and they could send this person out to do various things. He developed a whole method of creating this type of personality split, and by 1935, his work was classified. I went and pulled the record from the Library of Congress on everything the guy wrote and was able to find three of his books. One, 1943, revised in 1957, a book called Hypnotism. The next one, interestingly enough, by the title of Spiritism, 1947, dealing with mediums and trance mediums. And then the third book, and the most important book, was The Future of the Human Mind, written in 1961, where he discussed many of the things within the context of that book later came out in the MK Ultra, which was the mind control programs of the CIA that were revealed in the early 70s. Use of LSD as an example. Estabrooks believed therapeutically you could use this in some reasonable way. And of course, today we look back on that and we all kind of laugh about it because it's sort of ridiculous that we would have pursued this. And yet our government, according to one June 1975 report to the president on the Commission of CIA Activities in the United States, showed that 8,000 servicemen and women had been given LSD just to see how we could manipulate behavior.
Yeah. Doctor, when essentially did HARP bring the black cloak of secrecy down over HARP?
Well, I think we kind of triggered a lot of it. I mean, there was a lot of it that was classified from the very beginning. And as we got vocal about this, in fact, I was thinking, you know, it was 10 years ago that you and I did the first broadcast on this subject. And
that's right. And at that time, HARP was supposedly an open scientific endeavor. It was just talk to us, interview us, whatever, it doesn't matter, it's all open.
They'd never show up on the radio.
Yeah, so then that's right, but when did the axe come down, roughly?
Well, 2003 is when it switched from the Air Force to Navy over to DARPA. But I think before then, what we started to see, Der Spiegel came over to interview us, and Spiegel TV came over to take a look at the thing, and they refused to even grant them interviews, and that began around 2003. It really went dark at that point. University of Alaska Geophysical Institute gets a lot of money, military money. It's over $1 billion budget now. I mean, this is the University of Alaska. This is a very small university, but we have a very powerful U.S. senator that's able to do that, and because of its location for studying the ionosphere, Alaska does, in fact, have the best location within the continental United States. So it's important from a research perspective. What we're concerned about is the dark nature and misapplication of technologies. I mean, we support a strong military and defense system, but let's make sure that it serves our interests.
Of course. And let's have some oversight with regard to how the testing is done. Do you know what kind of oversight has, if any at all, been in place with regard to what HARP is doing?
Well, the only oversight is essentially the military looking at themselves. And, and this is a bit of a problem. This is where the European Parliament has expressed their greatest level of concerns. And, you know, interestingly enough, when we testified at the European Parliament, it was February 5th, 1998, and a resolution was passed in January of 1999 that dealt with HARP, and it was in the context of the largest and most comprehensive security and disarmament resolution ever passed by the European Parliament. And our sections on HARP calling for open disclosure and a complete investigation were actually passed by the highest margins. The one section that we got added in underneath the HARP sections was Section 27, and it calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings. And the reason we got that in the context of the HAARP dialogue, is we expanded that dialogue to include what are called non-lethal weapons and explained how HAARP could be used in this way. And then we demonstrated in the European Parliament in an open hearing an infrasound device that transferred sound information directly through our own biological neural network, our nervous system, into the brain. When we demonstrated that, that cinched it in terms of that section, in the act. And we also said that the same.
Doctor, hold tight, just one moment. We're right up against the clock and a break. From Manila, in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Here I am. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest, and he has done years and years of research into HAARP. Now, HAARP, as he just told us, went dark, probably hard dark, around 2003, and since then we really don't know what they've been up to. Suspect? Yes, but no. No, indeed, we don't know. There is much else to talk about now with Dr. Begich. He's done many years of research on other related fields, and we're about to get into those. Stay right where you are. Once again, Dr. Nick Begich. Bob in Montreal, Canada says, hey, Art, is there a relationship between HAARP and cell phones? Can HAARP tap into cell phones somehow? And I think the answer to that is clearly no. HAARP has other uses. But a good question for the good doctor. It just runs right into that in a way. There have been a lot of recent reports. We've had guests here on the show talking about cell phones being used to monitor conversations as bugging devices.
Right.
Dr. Begich, this is something you've been working on, apparently. What do you know?
Well, you know, we actually wrote about this in January of 2000 in the book Earth Rising the Revolution, and we talked about what are referred to as roving wiretaps, and it was permitted under law. And you know, and what has happened is there's been a recent court case where actually the FBI finally, through this the judge's action, ended up being tagged as being able to use the roving wiretap method this way. Once they get a warrant on someone, what they can do is trigger cell phones within the vicinity of that individual by downloading a little bit of software into those cell phones to where they actually kick on and act as a microphone. And every cell phone has this capability. And when you think about it, it's kind of a way to sweep into a neighborhood. You know, you can get close proximity to an individual, kick open somebody's cell phone, maybe not even that person's, and then monitor the conversation. The same thing, according to the articles that were released on this recently, they can do the same thing with the OnStar systems that are in many of the modern automobiles, where you have this emergency link up where you can talk to someone with
sure.
with the appropriate warrants, and now those are pretty liberally given. It's quite easy. The electronics actually, not just as a microphone, but something else that we've talked about for years is the requirement that cell phones have a GPS system, a geographic positioning system built in. They said it was for our safety for those 911 calls so they could locate us. The reality is every time you make a phone call, where you call and when you call, and who you call, are all three of those data elements tracked? And in roving wiretaps, they have the ability to literally capture all of those conversations within a region, and supposedly they're not going to access the data without warrants. But consider this. If all data is kept and stored, and sometime down the road they decide to take a look at your personal communications, they can take a backward look and open up your entire life. And this is this is the very tip of the surveillance iceberg in terms of where it's headed. And we've been reporting on it now 6 years, and finally the mainstream media is starting to pick up on some of the themes that we were getting out of the Department of Justice newsletters out to law enforcement. I mean, we were looking at all of the things they were doing internally as they begin to build the bridges to these technologies for domestic use.
All right. I want to talk about this a little bit. I believe it's true. I think that it's a technology that's well within our reach. That is to say, put a little software on somebody's phone, turn it on, listen to what's being said. Now, that's pretty radical. However, given the threat against the United States, the current threat against the U.S., 9/11 and since.
Right.
I'm not, if I was the president of the United States and I was presented with this option as a way to protect the citizens, and I understand all the ways that it can be misused. However, I think that if I was a president of the U.S., I might very well authorize something like that, as big brotherish and horrible as many people believe it to be, certainly in misuse, I might authorize it because I just don't know how we fight what we're facing otherwise, Doctor.
Well, you know, I think this is just by the hesitation in your voice. I know that you wrestle with that even as you think about it, as we all
do. Of course.
The balance of safety and security against liberty and freedom. And I can't remember how the saying goes, but I mean, if you bank on your safety and security, you in exchange for liberty end up with neither. And I think
right.
That's probably true in the long run. I was reminded of that recently by an individual who talked to me about that. And, you know, I struggle with it because it's always that balance. But at the same time, who sets the perimeters? You know, as long as everything is running smoothly and we go, well, we don't have anything to hide, we're not really worried about it. But every once in a while, somebody surfaces that has a different view of what's right and what's wrong than maybe most of us share. And the access to information and misuse of information seems to be the hallmark of a government that operates in secrecy. Now, granted, international terrorism is a significant issue. In fact, if you go back to a paper written by the U.S. Army War College called The Revolution, Military Affairs, and Conflict Short of War, it was written in 1990. And what it was about, this Revolution, Military Affairs, was about changes in the technology that would allow for incredible capabilities, including these kinds of surveillance capabilities. They talked about implant technology for tracking people's movements and so on. And what this paper at the U.S. Army War College said is these technologies would violate American values. Now, most of us think, okay, that's where it stops, but it didn't. It said we need to change American values by creating an environment of fear predicated on international terrorism and international drug trafficking. Now, this is the U.S. Army War College's paper, and when that paper came out, you kind of look at that, and 9/11 provided that opportunity in the sense that safety and security was the only issue at that moment, and people sort of looked the other way, and then after, you know, the Patriot Act and other acts passed, people went back and went, wait a minute, you know, hundreds sure. of local governments said, wait, we've gone too far. But that's exactly the situation they needed. Now, put this in perspective, international terrorism, as it affects American citizens, if you add up everything, including our casualties in Afghanistan and Iraq, we might come up with a number of around 10 or 12,000 in 10 years, which is a very big number. And no disrespect to anyone who's lost someone in any of these incidences, but compare it to medical malpractice in 10 years in the United States, according to Harvard, and a million people died.
Yeah, and or compare it to Vietnam and so forth and so on. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. But we do live in a day and age where eventually somebody's going to get hold of a nuclear device or a biological device that could wipe out a large part of the world.
Right.
That is what we're facing. Now, right. I'm well aware of our Bill of Rights. I'm very much aware of and in love with the Fourth Amendment. And we have lost some of those rights. There's absolutely no question about it. In fact, we've sort of given them away. But, you know, during the Second World War, as an example, Dr. Begich,
right.
We also, for a period of time during the war, gave away or were stripped of, however you want to think of it, those rights. And they were returned.
Right.
Now, and even strengthened after the war.
Sure.
So
There was a difference. There was a declaration of war against specific states. We're having a declaration against individuals who travel around the planet with no state affiliation whatsoever. We have never had a congressional declaration of war in this instance. In those situations where a war is truly declared by the Congress of the United States, not by the president, as is provided in the Constitution, at that point then, the suspension of civil liberties are understood. But when it's done under the guise of accelerating fear and stripping of civil liberties, it's really, what is this war about if it's not about maintaining the integrity and character of the Constitution? And then we see,
I don't think we're ever going to have another declared war, do you?
Well, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't say that. I think this country is certainly capable of doing that. I mean, we are for the first time since the Roman Empire, you know, we are the most powerful guy on the block. There is no one on the planet that can challenge us at the moment in the way that that we've been challenged in the past. So I think we've been running sort of unilateral wars and without declaration, without cooperation in the full sense. But at the same time, I think that's the tendency to warfare is not going to go away. The issue of terrorism is not going to go away. I think what we're seeing is a hardening exceptionally, you know, a greater degree of terrorism, I think, will emerge as we continue into this century just because of the conflicts between states.
No doubt. So, Doctor, if you were the president and they came to you and said, look, 9/11 is the beginning. Eventually, we're going to have suicide bombers here. We're going to have somebody's going to get a nuclear weapon into and or close to the coast, or a biological weapon. And the only way we can fight this, because it's not a conventional war, we're not going to have that kind of war anymore. Well, if there would be time to declare war before a full nuclear exchange, maybe there would be one more declaration, but it would be the last. So the future of warfare has changed. It's going to be what we're facing right now.
Right.
And other than the ability to gather information to prevent this kind of an attack, either we have that or we get attacked. And if you were the president, given that choice, knowing that that's true, and it is true, Doctor.
Yes.
What would you do?
Well, I think there is provisions in the law. There is the foreign intelligence courts and other courts that provide opportunities to go in and get the appropriate warrants with the appropriate steps. And there are people who are on their suspect list that certainly ought to be monitored. And, you know, when you look at this right now, over 60% of the cases the FBI is bringing right now forward for prosecution in the case of terrorism, according to recent articles, are being rejected by the Justice Department as not substantiated by the evidence. In other words, they can't even take them to trial. Now, I don't believe that the FBI is always right on target. In fact, right before 9/11, if you recall, the month before, the FBI was being raked over the coals by the Congress for messing up some of the biggest investigations in the country. And after 9/11, we gave them more power, more authority, more money, and less accountability. And I don't think that's an appropriate response. I think we need to make sure that they are operating efficiently. I think they need the latitude that they already have within the courts to gain those warrants. But I don't believe that every American should be the subject of that kind of inquiry. I just don't think that is the appropriate response. The appropriate response is isolate who's who, which we do a very good job of, and had things worked a little smoother, we might have been able to avoid some of the problems of the past. But the fact is, we have provision in law that allow the latitude government needs. When you start to look at how far that goes, certainly the overstepping of that is often the case, and unfortunately that's sort of the tension between the regulators and the bureaucracy in figuring out what's in our best interest. I think the President of the United States makes some very tough calls. I don't care whether liberal or conservative, the calls they have to make are the toughest ones of all, but at the same time, they are pledged to support and defend the Constitution. If you go back and look at the Founding Fathers' view, it was this idea of self-determination, independence, and the idea that people had a right to self-determination. We're in a conflict in Iraq, as an example, and we're there to win the hearts and minds and spread democracy. But that's not what the people apparently want. They want a theocracy, and if that's what they want in their own right to self-determination, maybe we need to recognize individual sovereignty as long as they keep it within the boundaries of their country and learn to leave people alone. We're the only country in the world with 800 bases and stations around the world to monitor and interfere with everyone else's politics. Maybe it's time to pull back a little bit towards our own borders, allow some governments to function. If they violate another state, if they violate the United States, I say stomp them into the Stone Age, as we did in Afghanistan. When we said give those guys up and they didn't do it, I think we were fully justified. But we need to take a very close account. When you talk about weapons of mass destruction, back in 1998, the Jerusalem Times reported that over enough plutonium had escaped the former Soviet Union to build 25 suitcase-sized nukes. We know they're around. We also know the materials used to construct nuclear weapons produce signatures that are very unique and can be located with a certain degree of efficiency when they're on the surface and not properly shielded, which is when you're transporting this stuff.
That's right.
And so you can't really hide them. The more sophisticated weapons, the electromagnetic weapons, are based on very unique frequencies and pulse widths and wave shapes and forms so that they can be picked out of the ether quite easily. So you really can't hide this stuff so easily. I think we have a lot more visibility than we think. The idea of biologicals are even a bigger problem. And historically, if you go back to the conflicts between Iran and Iraq when they were using chemical and biological weapons, the United States supported Iraq and the development of those weapons to counter what was going on with Iran. And the evidence of that has been presented by many authors over the years, including the receipts for the technology transfer signed by the Bush-Reagan White House.
Now, when you noted the hesitation in my voice, of course you are exactly correct. I only say this with the greatest hesitation and concern and worry. I don't like the fact that the Fourth Amendment is in rags and tags. I don't like it one bit. I don't understand how we fight this potential threat that would take out U.S. cities or worse. Biological, nuclear, whatever it might be, I just don't get how we fight this threat effectively without these kinds of, without the kinds of technologies we're talking about right now.
Well, I think we can use these technologies, again, when they're properly ordered by court action. And these court orders are very easily obtained. I mean, the foreign intelligence courts routinely granted them. Now, the Bush administration had a lot of warrants declined just for, I mean, really, really a lot of lack of evidence, because to get one through was fairly easily accomplished. You know, in today's flight down to Dallas, I read a book called Light and Liberty, and it's Thomas Jefferson's ideas about the founding ideas of the country. And it's really timely because, you know, when you think about what these founding fathers envisioned, wasn't a country that went out and engaged in every foreign conflict. In fact, it was just the opposite. It was one that recognized the role of government at the federal level, was to find the maximum happiness for its population, not to intrude in other people's foreign affairs. And I think we've created a lot of the problems by thinking that the Constitution somehow stops at the border of our country and we can go around the world and interfere with other people's politics, as we have. And I think this is, you know, this breeds a foreign policy that is hidden from public view, and foreign policy ought to be squarely in front of the American people so that we can weigh in on what is appropriate for our government to do. And in the case of using our technology to defend this country, I say develop the best and highest technologies, use them with proper oversight. And that's a big part of the problem. You know, the oversight is restricted in many cases to a very small select committee of the Congress, where they go in and look at black projects. And the problem is the level of scientific knowledge in the Congress. And I know this. My father was a United States congressman.
I know.
My family's been in politics for 50 years. And the level of scientific knowledge in the Congress is significantly deficient. I mean,
I fully understand.
You know, they talk about the Internet, and they talk about it as a bunch of tubes and pipes, for goodness sakes. And this was the chairman of Commerce, Science, and Technology Committee in the U.S. Senate. That's a sad state of affairs. And that needs to be addressed because technology is doubling every 9 to 10 months from the invention of the wheel to where we are at the moment.
And Doctor, maybe congressmen and senators need a technological liaisons who will help them understand what it is. I mean, that's about the only way, because they're political animals. They're not technologists. They need somebody who can tell them really what they're voting on. Doctor, hold it right there. We're here at the top of another hour already. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest. A relationship between RFID tags and cell phone technology, that is coming next. Stay right where you are.